Hi, good afternoon. I am here to talk to you about a study that was conducted at CDC that will very much support some of what Sean O'Leary presented. Our study was called Issues Associated with Immunization of Healthcare Workers Against 2009 H1N1. First, I'd like to acknowledge my colleagues who worked on this project, Kelly Jackson, Valerie Johnson, John O'Connor, Abigail Tumpy, Alan Jansen, who was the principal on this investigation, Chris Sheedy, and Dick Tardiff. To give a little bit of background, and many of you have probably heard this in other presentations so far during the conference, but the first cases of the new flu were reported in Southern California near the U.S.-Mexico border in March of 2009. In April, in San Antonio, a school district was closed, and a 23-month-old Mexican child dies in a Texas hospital. This was the first flu-related death outside of Mexico. And then in May of 2009, a 33-year-old Texas woman died after giving birth during her eighth month of pregnancy. She was thought to be the first flu-related death of a U.S. resident, who declared the worldwide pandemic in June of 2009, and in August, clinical trials of the first H1N1 vaccines began at 8 sites across the U.S. And also in August of 2009, the first media reports of adjuvanted vaccine, or the possible use of adjuvanted vaccine, were starting to concern the public. In this study, we wanted to explore the knowledge, attitudes, and beliefs of healthcare workers regarding H1N1 disease and vaccine. And we defined healthcare workers as pediatricians, other healthcare workers, including registered nurses and nurse practitioners, PRNs, and also service personnel, people who worked in the hospital, not necessarily in a clinical setting. We also sought to explore pediatric professionals' likely use and their attitudes about recommending H1N1 vaccine to their patients and requiring or recommending it to their employees. And also we gathered responses to specific information materials that you'll see in a few minutes. We held interviews and focus groups with pediatricians, other clinicians, and hospital service workers in Houston, Chicago, and San Francisco. And these regions were chosen specifically because they had high rates of H1N1 disease during the spring of 2009. Overall, we had 178 participants. 28 were pediatricians, 12 nurse practitioners, 88 were considered other clinicians, and 50 service workers. So first, I'd like to talk about the results when we looked at the knowledge, attitudes, and beliefs of healthcare workers regarding H1N1 disease and the vaccine. And pediatricians and other clinicians, the majority perceived H1N1 influenza as a moderately serious disease. You can see 67% of pediatricians and 63% of other clinicians thought of it as moderately serious. And service workers perceived it as even more serious than their clinical counterparts. 49% rated it as moderately serious, and 41% thought of it as very serious or life-threatening. We found in this study that the likely acceptors of H1N1 vaccine would be pediatricians. They were strong advocates for both the seasonal and H1N1 vaccines, reported that they would be getting it themselves, would recommend it to their staff and also their patients. And in terms of recommending it to their staff, many had the desire to require it, but understood that that wasn't likely to be in their control, so they were going to be highly recommending it to anyone on their staff, whether or not they had direct client contact. The other clinicians who we felt or we learned would be likely acceptors of the vaccine were clinicians who worked with high-risk patients or who already had experience with serious H1N1 disease, and those who had medical conditions or family members with medical conditions that would increase their risk from H1N1. And service personnel overall were very concerned about getting H1N1. They were concerned about exposing their families to H1N1 because of their role in the hospital setting or the clinical setting. And they were also concerned about losing work due to illness. So they reported being likely acceptors of the vaccine. Interestingly, we found that those that were most likely not to accept vaccination with H1N1 were the non-physician clinicians, primarily registered nurses. And we learned from them that, in contrast to the service workers who wanted to protect their families and their patients, registered nurses seemed to want to protect themselves from their patients. So that was a surprising finding from this study. And now I'll move on to the information materials that we presented first to physicians during the individual interviews, which were 30 minutes in length. And you can see, let's see if I can find the pointer here. There we go. We provided each physician with a product profile, and it included a description of the vaccine and the current situation, how it would be administered and stored, efficacy, and potential side effects, and contraindications. And much of this information was based on what we know about seasonal flu vaccine. Overwhelmingly, physicians were extremely comfortable with the information provided. They felt like the efficacy and the adverse events were comparable to seasonal influenza vaccine, which made them very comfortable. I'll go back one slide. We did include the possibility of adjuvanted vaccine for their information, and that did not present a concern to them. In fact, they've in some cases viewed it as positive because of their experience with vaccines that are already licensed and used that include adjuvants. The emergency use authorization, however, was a phrase that was not recognized by any of the physicians that we interviewed. And Dr. Leary brought that up, and I actually wanted to just give you the definition of the EUA in case it is a new phrase to you as well. So bear with me one second. An emergency use authorization may be issued by FDA to allow either the use of an unapproved medical product or an unapproved use of an approved medical product during certain types of emergencies with specified agents. So that term was brand new to physicians. It didn't seem to bring out alarm. It just was something that they were completely unfamiliar with. And so we'll need to do some communication with physicians and with the general public if indeed at some point we need to use the emergency use authorization process and get their feedback. There was limited concern regarding the rapid development or the this is their perception. Rapid development of the H1N1 vaccine, there was a concern that two injections and two visits might be an issue for parents, especially of young or multiple children. We had limited concern about the possibility of Guillain-Barré syndrome, and then it did come up that physicians were concerned that the fact that much of the H1N1 vaccine would contain thimerosal, that parents would have an issue with that when they got to their offices. Now I'd like to talk about the information materials that we presented to the other clinicians and service workers during focus groups. There were two materials presented, not during the same focus groups, and this might be a little complicated to explain, but I will do my best to make it clear. There were two versions of the information sheet called the 2009 H1N1 swine flu vaccine. Version one had information about adjuvants, thimerosal, and the EUA process included early in the document. And that was to test how bringing that material up front, how that would affect the way that the H1N1 vaccine was perceived. And version two was a version where we included the information about adjuvants, thimerosal, and EUA in the last section, and I think in better context of the pandemic situation. So this is version one, and you can see we introduce the fact that there is a new strain of flu, that we understand that getting the seasonal flu vaccine will not protect you from H1N1, and then we introduced the topic of adjuvants and the EUA process, just following that, before we actually got into who should be vaccinated, who should not be vaccinated, how the vaccine is administered, potential side effects, the availability, and cost. And before I get into the results of how both of these information sheets were perceived, I'll show you the second. The second, we put the information that we knew at the time at the beginning, including a brief summary about the current situation, and again, who should get the vaccine, who should not, how it's administered, where it will be available, how much it will cost, potential side effects. And then we presented the adjuvant thimerosal and EUA information in the context of when it would actually be used, and that is in the case of an H1N1 vaccine shortage. And here are the results from the testing of these materials. Early mention of adjuvants and EUA caused immediate concern, and it caused immediate mistrust. It brought up a concern about the safety of the vaccine. Participants were not, this was the first time that they had heard about adjuvants and felt it was an unknown ingredient. They perceived it to be something that was new. And that, in combination with the emergency use authorization process, led people to believe that it was somehow an experimental process. It was quite alarming to the participants who saw this version of the information sheet. And then again, they also, because of these facts, believed that, or perceived, that the H1N1 vaccines may be receiving rapid FDA approval without sufficient clinical testing. And thimerosal use in both cases, with information sheet one and two, was reported as a concern by most of the participants. Sorry, I think I went backwards. Also, other clinicians and service workers with information sheet version one were concerned that they wouldn't have full immunity after both doses and that they were going to be required to get vaccinated 21 days apart. And they were worried that within that time window, were they susceptible to disease? Was it worth getting the vaccine? Were they too late? And then again, this early mention of adjuvants in EUA seemed to stop participants from moving on to the most important information that we wanted to convey, and that is the efficacy of the vaccine, how it was produced, who we recommended the vaccination for, the cost, availability, and side effects. In contrast, for information sheet version 2, where adjuvants and EUA were mentioned in the last section in context to the H1N1 pandemic, messages about efficacy and production, the recommended groups, cost availability, were read and understood by participants. When they did get to the last section, they had questions, but the level of alarm was strikingly less. They just weren't as concerned about it as they were when they read about it in the beginning, in the first sheet. They wanted to know more information about adjuvants in EUA, but not in the context of fear and mistrust and just alarm. But again, like I mentioned in the previous slide, thimerosal was a source of concern. And I've heard that actually in many presentations throughout this conference. So our lessons learned, primarily based on these two information sheets, we felt that our findings were consistent with established risk communication principles, that when we're developing messages and materials, it's most important to first focus on what you know now. Talk about cases, talk about the vaccine production schedule and status, anticipated efficacy and safety, availability, cost. And also, very importantly, in times of crisis or fear, target readability at lower reading levels. We also learned that limiting the use of terms that may elicit confusion or mistrust is extremely important, and that delivering messages about a new or a product that may be unknown to the public or even providers, and in this case, adjuvants, or the EUA process, it's important to put those messages in proper context to the situation. There are limitations to the study. Because we had a small number of pediatricians, 28, we feel that we can't generalize to all pediatricians. There could be potential biases. For example, we told participants up front that this study was being conducted by CDC, so there could be some bias there if we were hearing information or if they were relaying information that they felt we wanted to hear. And then qualitative research is a costly way of doing research. The strengths, this provides us an opportunity to find out the whys behind some of the quantitative data. For example, that Sean presented earlier. Also, this type of research is valued because it allows us to identify barriers and problems that we can correct in an ongoing fashion while the situation is unfolding. And it lays the groundwork for future research on vaccine safety and efficacy. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Let's have some questions. To begin, I do have one for Sean, and it's interesting to compare Sean's question about likelihood of giving vaccine to your patients. The pediatricians were about 78%, and the general internal medicine were so much higher. And of course, in Tanya's had 96, but that was for a focus group. But I'm still surprised that pediatricians would be less likely than general internal medicine physicians to want to provide flu vaccine for their patients. And I just wondered if you had a thought on what just seems unusual to me, because pediatric patients are always getting vaccines. I would expect them to be more likely.
You know, I think it wasn't too big of a difference. I think it was 78-84% was the difference, so not huge. And I think that was reflected in some of our data that I didn't present, was that pediatricians were more concerned about the lack of data about the safety and efficacy. And so that may have been the root of that difference. So it was really only about a 6 percentage point difference between the pediatricians and the internists and family physicians.
Right, it's not much. I would have expected it, you know, to be flipped the other way. So that was an interesting finding. Are there any questions? I do have one for Sarah.
Okay.
Your survey sampled parents who had children, at least one child less than 1 year of age, right?
0 to 18.
Oh, okay. I must have misunderstood that, because I thought if you sampled parents with just really young children, they would be less likely to want to go to a school.
Obviously,
that would be very unfamiliar to them. Okay.
Ready for snacks.
They're ready. Well, they must be ready for my information on snacks. I really want to thank our presenters. I thought that was really a wonderful group of presentations.